Elise Glink joins us now, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. How are you, Elise?
Oh, staying warm, staying inside. You, John?
Yeah. The same. I started the show today just reminding everybody that if this was a football or basketball game, we're in the fourth quarter. This is, you know, where the going gets tough and the tough get going. Just hunker down. And the next thing you know, we're halfway through February. It's going to be March. The average high temperature 1 month from today is 48 degrees, so you don't have that much longer to go. How does that sound?
Sounds perfect.
Not everybody agreed with that. talk to me about the real estate trend right now. What are you noticing?
You know, one of the things that came out this week was a new survey by a company called IPX 1031, named for the exchange where you can exchange your commercial or investment property. It's 1031 tax-free exchange, owned by Fidelity National. And 51%, so just over half of Americans, now believe buying a home is realistic. And only 53% say they can afford to buy a home, while 66%, 2 in 3, still see homeownership as the American dream. And get this, John, almost 90% see homes as a good investment.
Yeah. What's your interpretation of that? Are those numbers good or bad, high or low?
Well, I'm a little worried that only half of Americans basically think that buying a home is a realistic goal for them, or that they say that they can even afford to buy a home. I mean, I think if you want an American dream, like a home ownership, the idea that you can live in your home, control your house, control the expenses, I think a lot of people are aware when they say that, you know, 88% say buying a home is a good investment. What they understand is that home prices go up over time, their costs are fixed, and so it allows them to build more wealth, both inside their home, because every single mortgage payment pays down a little bit of that principal and balance and builds up your equity. But also because when you fix your costs, then you can invest the rest of the savings every month in, you know, some other place like your retirement fund or a savings account.
Yeah.
And so this is a big disparity for me that, you know, half of Americans think it's realistic to buy a home, and yet so many people want to do it and just must be getting frustrated that they can't.
By the way, as an aside, you just mentioned principal and interest and the value of owning a home because you pay down the equity a little bit or build equity a little bit. We have a car and we didn't have that many car payments left. And the statement we got said that we owed like maybe $1,200 or $1,300 on the car, which we could have stretched out to 3 or 4 more payments. But anyway, I called to see what the payoff would be minus the additional months of accrued interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like $300.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was many, many more times the additional payments I would have to make. I suppose if you get near the end of a car loan or some sort of loan, see what the payoff is, because I'm going to save $500, say, on interest because I'm just going to write one extra check and get the thing over with, you know?
So that's a great point, John. And when you have a 30-year loan, by the time you get to the last 10 payments, there's almost no interest left in that, right? The last couple of years, because what happens with an amortization schedule, right, is you pay all of your interest up front, and by the end, there's very little left. Well, when you have a shorter loan, like a car loan of 3, 5, 7, or, you know, even 9-year car loan, you know, that's all compressed. And so by the last, as you found out, the last 5 or 6 payments, there's still a decent amount of interest.
Yeah.
And if you're saving $300 or $1,000, boy, wouldn't you just rather put that somewhere else?
I was glad to hear that 90%+ think that a home is still a good idea, a good investment. I thought that you were going to say that 51% of people think they can afford it. Was that the number? 49% can't?
Yeah, 53% say they can afford to buy a home, so 47% say they cannot. And that's a troubling number, John,
okay,
for sure.
All right, fine. I take you at your word, but I wonder what it was before the pandemic or 2 years ago or 10 years ago. I mean, you know, affording a home is never going to be easy.
It's not, but typically when you look at the percentage of first-time buyers that are out there, right, what you want to see is that at least a third of buyers, a third of, you know, 30, 34, 35% of shoppers out there, or even 40% are first-time home buyers. Ideally, it could be even half. And what we saw prior to the pandemic was that at least half of, not quite half, but in the 40% range were first-time buyers. And now, I didn't look up this number before today's show, but the best of my recollection is we're looking at, you know, something like 17 to 25% of home buyers are first-time buyers. It is a much lower number historic.
Elise Glinks with us on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the owner of ThinkLink Media and Best Money Moves. You find her stuff at thinklink.com. By the way, just a couple of comments to the show, Elise, while you were talking. Can I bounce them off you?
Oh, yeah.
My car and homeowner's insurance is what my first house cost me 40 years ago.
Oh.
Yeah. So the car and homeowner's insurance are the equivalent of your old mortgage payments, huh? People are struggling right now due to skyrocketing real estate taxes and homeowner's insurance, not to mention maintenance and repair costs. Costs aren't fixed. Right. So while you were talking about how roughly half of us think we can afford a home and half of us can't, it's maybe not the mortgage payment. It's all those other payments, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. So in Illinois, in Chicago, let's talk about Chicago, we have pretty much higher than everyone else, except a handful of places, property taxes. We all feel it, right? It's expensive. We pay 2%, of the value of the home around there, some more, some less. It's a little unfair, towards property taxes. And then we've got homeowners insurance. But down in Florida, where property taxes are high, but also homeowners insurance is skyrocketing, right? They just have, they don't have a state tax. And so it's interesting when...
Or state income tax.
State income tax is what I, right. So, you know, it's interesting how, you know, governments have to fund themselves, and that's kind of how that happens. But I hear you, you know, it's expensive, and one of the reasons why rental properties here in Chicago are so expensive for people also is that you got to pay the owner's mortgage and property taxes and insurance costs and all the rest there too. So,
right. He's passing it along, or
exactly.
She is. My property taxes, John, have gone up. Property taxes have gone up 30% over the last 3 years. Between taxes, car and homeowner's insurance, I'm going to the poorhouse. We petitioned our county to reduce, you know how you do the appeal. And
yeah.
Then you find comps.
And what happened?
What do you think happened? You're almost afraid to tell them that you live there because they might raise it. So I was just happy they said, nah, you're good. We're going to leave your taxes where they are, which is about all you're going to get these days. What happened to the commission structure?
So do you remember last year we had that big National Association of Realtors settlement for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars? You know, they had to pay because they were accused of colluding on the commissions and forcing buyers and sellers and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, I think a lot of that was going on, you know, where the realtor came in and said to the seller, yep, the commission 6%, you know, take it or leave it. And so there was this big settlement. And at the time, you said to me, what do I think will change? And I said to you, nothing. And in fact, I wrote a story at thinklink.com about my take on it, which was that nothing would change. Well, now we've got some numbers. And it turns out, wait for it, drum roll, nothing has changed. So since August, which is when everything went into effect, according to a study released by Redfin, basically, everybody is paying the same amount of real estate commissions to sell their homes as they were before. And in fact, for homes that sold for less than $500,000, Redfin found that the average commission has actually increased since the rules took effect. The only thing that seems to have changed here is paperwork, where we now require buyers to say, I'll pay the commission if the seller won't. And the seller has to sign paperwork that says, you know, I'm only responsible for this, but I have the right to offer to pay the buyer's commission. And there you go.
think the concern was that the realtors were going to take a real hit, because not only would it be more transparent, but now I'm going to get confused here, but the one side would have to almost negotiate with the realtor for what they thought was a reasonable commission, and the other realtor would have to expect to be paid from that. But it wasn't going to be 6% divided by 2 or whatever the math worked out to be. You're saying what happened to the commissions overall to the realtors?
Nothing. The commissions are still being paid at the same level or even higher than they were before, which is stunning. I got to say, just stunning, people, because we're in still one of the hottest seller's markets in history. Homes are still selling at a record pace, right? Maybe not quite as fast as a couple of months ago, but, you know, there's a home that in Winnetka that literally had like 11 offers in 24 hours the other day.
And what is stunning to you about this then?
Well, what's stunning to me is that in a hot market, you would expect to be able to say to the agent,
exactly.
Listen,
yeah.
You don't have to do this much work. I'm not going to pay you 6% or 7%. How about 4%, 2% for you, 2% for the buyer's agent? And that's not happening. Or you would expect sellers to say, I'm going to try selling on my own.
Yeah.
Because I could stick a sign in the yard and get 6 offers. But that's not happening either. So it's just interesting that if the goal is, as one compliance person in the real estate industry said, if the intention was for sellers not to be paying buyers agents compensation, it's a total fail. It's just the industry is continuing as it was, and they're just repackaging it in a different way.
You sent to producer Pete and me some of the good deals that are out there. I alluded to mattresses on President's Day. What else have you noticed?
Some good sales. Good Morning America ran a big thing this morning. Laptops, you can save on a 2022 Apple Air. You can save $200. Dell computers, you're saving $250 to $300. Big screen TVs are, I can't believe this, John, but you can get a Samsung 65-inch big screen TV for $349.
Yeah.
There's Gap, Lands End, Adidas, all Macy's jewelry. They all have sales up 30 to 50 to 70% off. And then over at Walmart, they had a bunch of flash deals that I thought were sort of interesting. Yes, the mattresses, you can get a decent price on that. You can save a couple $100 on a Dyson vacuum cleaner. But what I've noticed is that these are must-have things, right? People aren't necessarily shelling out on, they have the money to shell out on kind of want things. Like the stuff that's being advertised that I've seen are things that are practical, that will change your life. Silverware, for example, you know, different kinds of plugs to make it easier to plug in your electronics. I'm not seeing as much of things that are kind of nice to have.
Yeah, I get that too. Some of these savings are pretty extraordinary, you pointed out to us. By the way, as we wrap this segment up, we heard from a realtor. You were talking about the commissions. Pretty much everybody's still getting paid, but it's the paperwork that's different. 520 texted in and said, I'm a realtor. And Elise is absolutely correct. It's a paperwork nightmare. Thanks for listening. And Elise, as always, thanks for joining us. We'll talk again next week.
Sounds like a plan.
Shannon Martin joins us now, an insurance analyst at Bankrate.com. We were just talking with Elise Glink, who is a money analyst and real estate expert on our show before you came on. She and I were talking about the cost of home ownership. And one of the things our listeners reminded us is that it's not just the mortgage payment. It's the interest and insurance costs that are making home ownership really difficult these days. At Bankrate, you have a story about auto insurance. What's the latest on that?
Yes. Well, really, the cost of car insurance is making vehicle ownership more complicated and more difficult. Our latest true cost of auto insurance report just came out. We found that on average, Americans are spending around 3.39% of their household income just towards car insurance costs.
So what kind of raw numbers are we looking at then?
The national average cost of car insurance is $2,638, and that's for full coverage.
$2,638. I'm paying a year on my average vehicle. Average car is about $45,000, and I'm going to pay $2,600 a year in premiums for the insurance coverage?
That's correct. Now, that's if you live, you know, that's the national average. So we found that in a state like Louisiana. We looked at also the median household income. So a driver in Louisiana puts almost 7% of their household income towards car insurance. Their rate is around $3,900 a year. But the flip side is if you live in Hawaii, you're only paying around $1,600 a year and around 1.7% of your household income towards car insurance.
In Louisiana, the income is lower, so it would be a higher percentage, and the average auto insurance number is more expensive. Not exactly sure why. Everything's more expensive in Hawaii, though. Do they have fewer accidents in Hawaii?
Well, in Hawaii, the median household income is a lot higher, but a lot of the area, driving area, is really rural. So even though it is a vacation spot with a lot of destination travel, there's not a big risk factor in terms of car crashes for travel as compared to places like Louisiana, Florida, and New York.
So if it's $2,600, the national average, you also broke it down by metro. Seattle, Tacoma is $1,986. That's the average annual premium, 1.79%. So who knew? Seattle, very inexpensive, relatively speaking, for car insurance. In Chicago, we're number nine on a list of 25 metros, so not bad. $2,408 is our average annual. If you're listening to us in the Chicago area, on average, you're paying $2,400 a year in car insurance. Wow.
Yep, that's right.
Still sounds like a lot to me. I, off the top of my head, don't know what I'm paying. I've got a couple of cars. One of them's 11 years old. The other one's 7 years old. I suppose the age of the car affects the insurance rate, right?
It absolutely does, because the cost of the comprehensive and collision is usually the most expensive portion of an auto policy. And the newer the car is, the more value it has. And it might have more parts like microchips, cameras, things like that, that cost a lot more now. And we have a lot more of those in our vehicles. We're experiencing a technician shortage. The cost of parts and labors have gone up. So newer cars tend to cost more. But someone like yourself that might have a new car in their policy and an older car, like an 11 or 12-year-old car, you're getting the multi-car discount, which is really going to help lower the cost of that newer car down on your policy.
What else is adding to or moderating the insurance costs for cars these days?
There's a lot of things kind of at play. We've had a long road here with fluctuating cost of living is not kept up with the rate of inflation. We've had the there's been a spike of accidents and over 10% increase in car crash fatalities occurred at around 2020. And while our driving has improved, we haven't gone back to pre-pandemic numbers yet. So we're still focusing on that. And then the cost of like health care and medical payments, all of these things have kind of increased dramatically over a short period of time, making the cost of car insurance just much higher than we're used to having it.
I think the math that a lot of us struggle with is trying to figure out the premium versus the deductible, right? So I can pay less each month if I raise my deductible, the amount I have to pay. But I don't want to risk that, so I'll say, okay, I want to get the deductible down as low, but then the premium goes up. I don't know if I'm going to have a crash or somebody's going to hit me. I wonder if there is an industry standard. Do you have any advice for us on how best to manage those two things?
Absolutely. I was an insurance agent for about 16 years, and one thing I noticed is that most people don't realize that the comprehensive and collision deductibles do not need to match. So it's common to have a $500 or $1,000 comprehensive and collision deductible. But let's say if you have $500, if you want to save the most money, you can go from $500 to $1,000 just on collision and keep your comprehensive the same, because it's not going to save you that much money. And then there are deductibles that are higher. Some carriers let you go up to $2,500 if needed. The trick to that is you really need to have an emergency savings account on hand, so that you know if you are to get into an accident, you have access to those funds to pay your deductible at the time of the loss.
During the pandemic, I recall that the reason that the car insurance rates went up so much, I think people were driving faster and crazier because there were fewer people on the roads, but it was also a supply chain issue for parts, right?
That is correct. There was a supply chain issue at the time. And now as consumers, we actually don't notice the supply chain issues as much. During the pandemic, if you went to purchase a new car, you were waiting and waiting for these different parts to come in. There's a lot of talk right now about pending tariffs and what may happen, but there are tariffs that have always been, you know, with America and other countries, and there are still some supply chain issues that we're just not really seeing as much when we purchase a car, but they still happen when it comes time to repair the vehicle. And so our repair times and things like that have actually gotten longer, which can increase cost of your car insurance as well.
I just don't know how a tariff on steel won't increase the cost of a car repair, because the cost of imported steel will go up right away, but American manufacturers won't suddenly be able to turn on a bunch of new steel plants where they're going to crank out more steel. Maybe they can at the existing ones, but I would imagine there would be a lag time. So suddenly you're in a crash, your guy's going to need to replace the door that's made of metal, and he's either got to pay 25% more, that's right now, from Canada, or he's going to have to buy it from American manufacturers who aren't ramped up for the extra production, and supply and demand being what it is, they will charge you more for that door. It has to be inflationary, at least in the near term.
It does. That's exactly right. So what'll happen is a lot of manufacturers may try to find different ways to get the parts to America, find different trade routes. That takes time. So that's going to put a delay on repairs almost right away. But the other thing to think about is that car insurance is reactionary. So any increase that happens now, you might not see it in your car insurance premium in 2025. It usually kicks in about 18 months down the line. So you're going to see an increase maybe next year. But what might happen is if you're in an accident, you have a coverage called rental reimbursement, if you've included it, where you can have a rental car. Usually it's about 30 days at the most. But more and more delay times mean more people need rental cars. They'll run out of that coverage. And the cost of renting a car is going to increase for drivers as well.
The least expensive state for auto insurance is Hawaii, Vermont, New Hampshire, Idaho, and Washington State. Most expensive, Michigan, Nevada, New York, Florida, and Louisiana, having to do with a number of factors, income, crashes, etc. Illinois is number 20 out of 50 states. Our annual insurance cost is around $2,300. The national average is $2,600. We're a little bit better than average. We're not as bad as Seattle, or pardon me, we're not as bad as Orlando, Detroit, Tampa, and Miami. Miami pays $5,174 annually for the average car insurance. Wow. 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 Okay. Interesting report. You might want to read it and see how you might improve some of your costs. Shannon Martin is an insurance analyst at Bankrate. You can find this at bankrate.com. Nice to talk to you today, Shannon. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Walgreens Boots Alliance has received a negative outlook by Moody's Ratings. The Deerfield-based pharmacy chain has been downgraded from a stable outlook, as Moody's says industry pressures and liabilities are piling up. Grains reports Moody's negative outlook focuses on high execution risks associated with Walgreens' turnaround strategy. Credit rating agency says Walgreens could see an upgrade if that turnaround plan results in improvement in profitability and cash flow. Chicago's video shout-out company Cameo is giving $10,000 pay raises to employees who come back to the office 4 days a week. The company had previously said it had no need for office space and embraced the work-from-home model. Now the company's CEO says people are more valuable in person. The new back-to-the-office schedule is Monday through Thursday. Cameo is also picking up lunches, parking, and gym memberships. 26 of the company's 50 employees are in Chicago. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Markets are closed today because of the holiday. Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and let's begin with this fella.
It's Sean Hayes.
Yeah, the Evergreen Park native and graduate of Glenbard West, an Emmy and Tony award-winning actor.
When I was asked to speak from the heart about food banks and panties, I thought, what an odd pairing, and why me? But upon learning it was food banks and pantries, I knew I had no choice but to participate.
More about that After, I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Sean Hayes is helping the Glen House Food Pantry raise money by asking you to enter a raffle to win a bottle, maybe two, of Blanton's Single Barrel Bourbon, which I'm told is hard to find.
Mostly because the bottle is a hand grenade-shaped bottle that has a little brass horse on top. Each horse is in a different racing position from in the gate to finish.
Jim Burkett is a board member of the pantry and the donor of the bourbon.
Each one has a letter on it that spells out Blanton's. A lot of people try to collect all of them.
More about the raffle after we hear about the pantry. Demand has never been greater there.
Even in DuPage County, which is one of the wealthiest in the state, almost 83,000 people are at risk of hunger. And so our fundraising efforts are more important than ever before.
That's Laura Glaza, the executive director of the Glen House Food Pantry.
Our clients can shop once a month for a robust selection of not just canned goods, but fresh produce and even milk and eggs.
And they shop for free, which is where you and Sean Hayes come in.
You see, my mom, Mary Hayes, was involved in the Northern Illinois Food Bank right from the early days. She worked there tirelessly for years while raising five kids as a single mom. Can you imagine? That's nearly as difficult as my job.
Well, your job is to enter the raffle. The deadline is a week from Wednesday, and here's where to enter and donate.
Yep, our website is glenhousefoodpantry.org.
And they love volunteers, too. glenhousefoodpantry.org. Mr. Hayes?
I will draw the winning ticket in February, and while I can't guarantee you'll get the bourbon, I can promise you'll feel like a winner when you help a family in need put food on their table.
On the food calendar, it's National Cabbage Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Lauren Huff, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I suppose everybody is now February 17th. I wonder what percentage of the people who said they were going to exercise 4 days a week or every day are still doing that.
Oh, I hope it's a high percentage.
Well, so you are over at the Palatine location for the Midtown Athletic Club. Is that right?
I am based out of our corporate office, which oversees all of them. But I am based in Illinois, which is where our Palatine location is. Yes.
What's a good tip for people? I suppose you've had this conversation before. Give us some advice.
For recovery specifically or starting a new regimen?
Well, you pick.
I'll say my best advice for somebody who's starting a new regimen or has very specific goals they're looking to achieve, I'd say to truly look for something that you enjoy, because something that you enjoy is something that you're going to be able to do consistently, and that's really how you're going to meet your goals. So whether it's a specific class that you really enjoy the music and that's what keeps you motivated, or if it's something that makes you feel really strong and that's what keeps you motivated, the key really should be finding something that you enjoy and that you'll stick to and be consistent with.
Yeah. You know, I talked to a nutritionist last week who said the same thing. She wasn't talking about exercise so much as if you're trying to form a good dietary habit or any kind of habit, try and incorporate it into something else you like. So if it's exercise, do a dance class with music you like. Sounds like what you're saying.
Absolutely. If there's something that you really strongly dislike too in the same regard, maybe that's not something that you want to include in your weekly movement routine. So yes, I totally agree.
Would you say you should be patient also with either the new regimen or maybe recovering from an injury?
Yes, be very patient. Don't try to get everything done all in like 1 to 2 weeks. Let yourself start in small steps. If you're brand new to exercise, maybe you start planning out your week by moving 2 to 3 times a week and not feeling like you have to go from, 0 days to 7 days a week. That's really a way that might push you towards injury or just discouragement. Specifically to coming back from an injury, I'd say the same thing. Be really kind to your body. You want to program and schedule out movement in shorter increments, maybe 20 to 30 minute sessions, 2 to 3 times a week. And then as you feel stronger and more successful, then you increase your frequency and the amount of time you're spending so that you're not hurting yourself or discouraging yourself by maybe soreness or exhaustion or something like that.
One last thing, you also said plan out. And I wondered if you would agree or would advise people to do that. Should it be just a daily thing like, hey, I've got some time here? Or should I get on my laptop and schedule my workouts?
Ooh, I love this question. So my suggestion would to be to try to start maybe on like the weekend or on a Monday, put it in your phone calendar, set some reminders, commit to what your week's going to look like at the beginning of the week, and kind of mentally tell yourself these are non-negotiables because they're going to improve your quality of life. So yes, I think do it a week out if you can. And then once it's more of a habit, then maybe you could go to doing a daily, because, you know, we all feel different on different days. But I think planning and committing yourself and making it non-negotiable is really another key to being successful.
I suppose a place like yours has people who would help me start that journey out too, right?
Absolutely. We have a lot of programs, from one-on-one programs to group programs, which is really our bread and butter. So we have introductory level programs that are focused on recovery, programs that are meant to build strength so that you can then go into higher levels of fitness. So at Midtown, we definitely have a lot of programs that are great for entry level or beginner fitness level, or somebody who's had a little bit of a hiatus and they're looking to get back into it.
Lauren Huff is the National Program Director of Midtown Athletic Club in Palatine. Midtown.com is the website. Something to think about as we power through February. Lauren, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
You bet.